Hello, and welcome to another IMF podcast brought to you by the International Monetary Fund. Today, we're bringing you another podcast.
Welcome to Google Zeitgeist Podcast, an ongoing series where we bring together extraordinary leaders to focus on critical issues for the world. I'm Ruth Porat, the Chief Financial Officer of Alphabet and Google. And today, we're going to focus on the current state of the world and discuss what's needed to ensure sustainable growth globally and the implications if we fail to do so.
If I have one wish, it is that we figure out a way to massively expand investment in the developing world. Because unless we do, the K-shaped recovery will be complemented by K-shaped climate policies. And believe you me, it's not going to be sustainable.
Here's where I think we're going wrong. We're still talking about an era of COVID and a post-COVID era. I don't think there is going to be a post-COVID era for a very long time. This emergency is now endemic.
So why are we playing you Google's podcast? Well, as you might have guessed, IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva is featured in this episode, along with David Miliband, Chief Executive Officer of the International Rescue Committee. So your host today is Ruth Porat.
A very warm welcome to you both. I want to start with your outlook for the global economy, in particular, the divergence of outcomes between developed and emerging countries. COVID clearly placed a harsh spotlight on inequities in our global society. And so let's talk about the outlook from here. Kristalina, let's start with you.
Let me first thank you for having us with David. I could not think of a better partner to talk about the future of the world. We are stepping into 2021 with more hope for growth at, right now we are setting it at 5.5% for the year, maybe even higher. And the question is, why is the prospect better? And there are three reasons for that. One, we don't give enough credit to the central banks and finance authorities for their incredibly swift and massive support for businesses and for households. Two, of course, the arrival of multiple vaccines. And three, we as people, as organizations, we have learned how to function with the pandemic still around us. Masks, social distancing, using digital technologies for those who can do their jobs virtually. All of this makes the prospects for 21 brighter, but we may have a little bit of sunshine and we have very, very heavy clouds still hanging over our heads. The race between the vaccines and the mutations, uncertain. How it is going to end, when it is going to end, will we ever end? The resolve of people to continue with these measures and of policymakers to continue to provide support, is it certain? And most importantly, are we really ready to wrestle with this huge divergence that is happening within countries and among countries? At the IMF, we label 2020 the year of the great lockdown. And Ruth, I'm very worried the label for 21 in history would be the great divergence, unless we act. And what we are pressing from the IMF is act domestically. We know who are the losers of this crisis: low-skilled workers, women, young people, businesses that are contact dependent. We know who are the winners. The digital economy is actually doing fantastically well. Can we have more fairness in our society in which we protect the social fabric by equally sharing the benefits for those who are doing well, and then concentrating on investing in people, in skills, in social protection, in health systems, above all, in this crisis. And can we recognize that unless we build resilience to shocks, this crisis may go away, another one will hit us. And I know that David sees that daily. I used to have a front row seat like him in the worst crisis of this planet when I was humanitarian commissioner. The climate crisis is upon us. The conflicts and wars that we are not quite attending, they are upon us. So building resilient people, building a resilient planet, and then recognizing that we need to be together as a world, that we need to take more care of each other whenever we are. And then comes the big issue of divergence across countries. And Ruth, allow me just to say this. We are looking at the data, and it is pretty scary. We know that half of the developing countries that were catching up in income levels with the better-offs are now falling behind. And we know that the loss of income between now and 22 on cumulative level in advanced economies is going to be 13%, in developing countries, emerging markets, 22%. So on top of it, we know, and these are the numbers that are just breaking my heart, that in this crisis, advanced economies were able to do a lot for their people and their businesses, the equivalent of 24% of GDP. Emerging markets, 6%. Poor countries, 2% of their tiny little GDP. So unless within countries and across countries, we build more transfer in a way of wealth, we would be coming out of this crisis faced with unrest, unhappiness, instability.
I could not agree more. When we look at the need for inclusive growth, we can't have sustainable growth if we don't have inclusive growth, to the points that you made. We can't have sustainable growth if we don't focus on resilience. And David, this sounds a lot like the call you've had, that we're living in an age of impunity and calling for greater accountability.
Well, I'll come to that, Ruth. I mean, I think that Kristalina's warning is actually just a truth, that we're heading for a K-shaped recovery at best. And we're seeing divergence in every aspect of life chances, right down to the 120 million people who are being driven into extreme poverty, according to the United Nations. Here's where I think we're going wrong. We're still talking about an era of COVID and a post-COVID era. I don't think there is going to be a post-COVID era for a very long time. This emergency is now endemic. And that means that even on the most optimistic scenarios for the distribution of vaccines, the people that we at the International Rescue Committee serve, is 2022, 2023, 2024 before they've got a shot at a vaccine. And by then, you're into all sorts of mutations. And so I think we need a mind shift where we think, hang on, we're going to be living in this state of abnormality for quite a long time, and we're going to have to adapt our systems of adaptation and mitigation, to borrow a phrase from the climate space, to help us get around that. And that's going to be incredibly challenging for multilateral organizations like Kristalina's. It's going to be very challenging for humanitarian organizations like us, who we're a growth industry for all the wrong reasons. And it's going to be very challenging for the big business players like you, Ruth, because people are going to be saying, well, what are you doing to stop this? And I think it's really stark. Now, you asked about what I call the age of impunity. That's a subsection of this K-shaped recovery. And the subsection is that for growing numbers of people who are the poorest in the world, They aren't just subject to poverty and misery and diminished life chances. They're also subject to unspeakable abuse of what are meant to be their rights to live, because civilians are being killed in war zones like never before. Aid workers also being killed in war zones like never before. And the idea of impunity is simple. Impunity is the actions without consequence, the power without responsibility, which is often said is the refuge of the harlot throughout the ages. And we're seeing on all of the data that's available that international law, which was established after the Second World War, is becoming observed less and less. And American retreat has been part of that, but it's not the only part of that. There's a shift in the global balance of power, and it's far too prevalent now to believe that the law is for suckers. And that's an international relations problem. It's a democratic recession problem. There's an argument about economic impunity as well. And I think for the poorest, what they see is sometimes talk about inequality, but not enough accountability for doing something about it. And that's where I think the challenge lies, and where I think there needs to be some really urgent rethinking. I'm sitting on a panel on the World Health Organization panel on pandemic preparedness and response. We need to move to a completely different mindset to how we think about global pandemics, how to prevent them and how to react to them. And that's just one example.
Well, let's spend time on another crushing crisis, which is climate change. You've both spoken quite a bit about climate change. Kristalina mentioned it here today. And obviously from California to Australia and everywhere in between, we're seeing the devastation of fires, the impact of climate change. It is here. It is now. There is an urgency, David, to use your term, on some of these rising issues. We see it in so much of the work that you're doing with the growth in climate refugees. So let's talk about what should be done there, core to what we're looking at Google. It's been a part of our ethos since day one. We've been carbon neutral since 07. We keep raising the bar on it. This is something that all of us, public sector, private sector, NGOs, need to be focused on now. So, David, do you want to start with climate refugees, what you're seeing, just help our listeners understand the magnitude of this and what needs to be done to help?
Yeah, we published our emergency watch list just last month. It's the 20 countries where we expect the greatest increase in humanitarian need this year. They represent 10% of the world's population, but 88% of the world's people in humanitarian crisis, 200 million people in total. What explains that? Conflict, the biggest driver of extreme poverty today, is conflict. Secondly, COVID. And thirdly, the climate crisis. And climate is an indirect multiplier of humanitarian need. I'm a bit leery of saying climate refugee, because a refugee is someone who crosses an international boundary because they're not safe at home. Most of the evidence is that people who move as a result of climate change stay within their own country. They're climate internally displaced, if you like. But the big indirect multiplier is that climate obviously causes resource stress. Resource stress is a driver of conflict. Conflict then creates refugees. So their indirect contribution of climate is real, I think, and it's ever present. I think there are two things that are really significant to me at the moment. First of all, there looks like for the first time ever, really, there's a coalition of the willing across Europe, China, North America, Japan as well, to do something. And we've never been in that situation. I was Environment Secretary in the UK in 2006-07. We published and passed the world's first legally binding emissions reduction requirements right through to 2050 for the UK. That's still in place. But we weren't on our own, but it was a struggle at the time. We've now got Chinese commitment to net zero, American commitment to net zero, European commitment to net zero, business commitments to net zero. This is all very significant. So the coalition of the willing is coming. But secondly, there's an absolutely vital principle, which is goes beyond saying we've all got to do something. And the principle is those with the most have got to do the most. I mean, when the 1992 Rio Agreement was for common but differentiated responsibilities, the differentiation was according to wealth and power. And that it shouldn't be a reason for countries to hide. It should be a reason for countries to step up, because, of course, there's enormous economic renewal potential in decarbonizing the economy and developing a route to industrialization that doesn't involve carbonization. But I think that we're going to have much more loss leading by the wealthiest countries in the world if they're to prove to the others that they're serious.
Thank you. Now, Kristalina, you've clearly placed climate change at the heart of the IMF's work. Can you take us through some of the actions that you're leading?
We recognize that as an institution, we work for what? Macroeconomic and financial stability. None of those are going to be there unless we wrestle with climate change. And what it translates for us at the IMF is to play on our comparative strength at the time of must-do transformation to the new climate economy. So first, we are the institution that gives fairly clear and useful advice on fiscal policies. Well, we are not going to get on top of this crisis unless there is the strong incentive of pricing carbon. We came up with a very clear message on that. We said today, carbon price about $2 a ton. It has to be today much more, and that within short period of time, we have to get to $75 a ton and then probably go even higher. And then we give advice on public spending. And this is now very critical because if countries are to get to net zero in 2050, guess what? They need to do their job now because investments that are done now are going to bite us in the butt if they are the wrong investments. So we concentrate on public spending. We believe that a green infrastructure push can both lift us up from the current crisis and help us deal with the climate problem. And it would generate additional 0.7% growth over the next 15 years, millions of new jobs that we are desperate for. And finally, data. We are going to launch in a couple of weeks a integration of carbon intensity into quarterly macro data reports. And I think that may be even bigger than anything else I spoke about, because if we get macroeconomic policy making to be truly integrative of climate risks and opportunities, then we would see change. And I want to finish by saying that we so much have run out of time to switch our mindset to managing risks in this more risk-prone world. And we are so complacent to our interdependence. The pandemic actually in that regard helped, made us a little more sober. We now know we are as weak as the weakest link out there, that we may immunize all of us. And as David said, a mutant will come and penetrate through our vaccination protection. And that is exactly the same case for climate. We are absolutely in this together. And if we don't act, we will be cooked.
Very much to your point that the investments we're making today are absolutely critical for trying to bend this curve. I mentioned that we've been carbon neutral since 2007. But to your point, we set a goal which we view as our most audacious goal, which is by 2030, we want all of our data centers and all of our office campuses running on renewable energy, which means we need over the next decade to catalyze the development of the renewable grid so we can never emit carbon. We just run it right off the grid. But that means starting now, which is what we've been very committed to. I completely agree with both of your comments that this is here and now, and we all have a critical role that we need to be playing if we're going to actually make the changes that need to be made. And with that, I'd love to hear you both comment on what more you would like to see in public-private partnerships on these issues. If you could pick an example of where you want to see, in particular, the private sector leaning in more, working with you to address issues. Kristalina, you want to take us there first?
Above all, to recognize that public policy matters, but it is the innovation coming from the private sector and the scale with which private sector can move, that would make a difference on many counts, not just on climate. We are now in a world where there is more recognition that public-private partnership is one in which we have to rely on our comparative strength, and that even when it is tense, it can be very, very productive. Specifically on the topic of climate, if I have one wish, it is that we figure out through public-private partnership a way to massively expand investment in the developing world. Because unless we do, the K-shaped recovery will be complemented by K-shaped climate policies and a K-shaped future, which, believe you me, is not going to be sustainable. We at the IMF are now working on how we can step up, work on policies for private sector participation in the economies of developing countries. And I would love to see that we get on all the tough issues there, from debt sustainability to massive increase of investments in food security and agricultural sustainability, reforestation, land degradation reversal, mangroves restoration, and do that on a scale that would make developing countries more resilient for their own sake and for the sake of everybody else. Because if they fall apart, trouble travels. Then we see the spillovers of insecurity affecting first their neighbors and their region, and then the rest of the world.
David.
Thanks, Ruth. I'd say three things about this are really important. First of all, when one thinks about the business sector, private sector, if you don't defend globalization, no one's going to be left there dealing with it. And you can only defend globalization if you're willing to bear the responsibilities of it, not just reap the blessings of it. The politicians in significant numbers have evacuated the terrain. They're not there. And you'll only be credible in fashioning public-private partnership, in defending the potential of a connected world, if you're willing to bear the responsibilities. Second, you can't bear the responsibilities if you're living under the tyranny of shareholder value. I mean, that's that myopia for the last 40 or 50 years explains a lot of the difficulties we're in, including impunity. Until there is a recognition that business is part of society, not separate from society, and has responsibilities to employees, to customers, to the common good, then there's no sustainable, or I think you said inclusive, capitalism, rightly. Thirdly, global public goods, like a clean climate, like health security, can't just be delivered by the public sector. But if the private sector is going to be able to contribute to the development of global public goods, my instinct is that businesses are going to have to collaborate with each other. Let me say something really, let me venture into terrain that I don't know enough about and I hope is not too sensitive. But we know there's a war on democracy at the moment. And we know that each of the different tech companies say they really care about it. But each of them working individually isn't going to have the same impact as them coming together. If you think about the arms trade says, look, we don't want our weapons to be used to bomb children in a coach in northern Yemen. It's not our fault. But until all of the arms manufacturers come together and their financiers come together and say it's a global public good that international law that bans the targeting of civilians is respected, it's not going to happen. And so I think there's a really fundamental challenge for individual businesses to go beyond seeing their quote-unquote projects as being boutique efforts and to see them as far more systematic. And so my reflection about public-private partnership, we're incredibly grateful to our private partners. Google has done some amazing things with the International Rescue Committee. We're doing some more now in Nigeria on climate resilience with data analytics, which I think is really exciting. But we've got to think beyond the individual project towards system thinking. And I can't believe I'm telling you this. I mean, you both know this better than I do. But system thinking in this area, I think, means international, not just national. It means stakeholders, not just shareholders. And it means collaboration with friends and enemies, as well as individual initiative.
I asked the question very much to that point. I very much agree with that, that we can amplify work and accelerate work when we come together. So as an example, at Google, we started digital skills training. We started creating the opportunity for the most marginalized to get digital skills to go into one of the fastest growing job areas, IT support. What we found, to your point, is that that was lovely, but it was much more impactful if we built a coalition of companies that would use the certificate. And then we worked with community colleges in the United States to, again, extend further. And it was about making the skills training program substantially more mobile, transportable, that we could accelerate the impact that we're having. I would say the same thing when we did the exposure notification contact tracing work with Apple. Our view was you want to be able to have insight across all mobile platforms. And so we came together in a way that said, let's team up on this because we have to do what we can together to have an impact on slowing this ghastly disease. So very much agree with that. And on that, we sadly don't have enough time, but I'd like to get from each of you, hear from each of you, if healthy growth is inclusive growth and it is sustainable growth, clearly technology can have an impact there. What are you most excited about with respect to technology and innovation that can help support this inclusive, sustainable growth that we've been talking about?
It is so demonstrably clear that technology can be a lifesaver. Now that our scientists have gifted us with multiple vaccines, I just got my Moderna second shot. And so I can be mobile, I can go and hug my granddaughter. We are in an era of accelerating change. And it is wonderful to see how that can completely change how we work, how we interact, and do it in a way that is opening up more opportunities for more people. What I'm most excited when we talk about technology, first, people, making lives of people better, easier, safer. And there, the critical factor inevitably is going to be digitalization, access to information everywhere. And that is, of course, your domain, Ruth. You would know much more than I do. But what I do know is that we looked at the continent of Africa. If we were to add 10% of the African population to access to the internet, not we, but if they, people were to do that, Africa's GDP is going to go up by 4 percentage points. What else can you come up with which has such a tremendous impact? The second big thing in technology is transparency and accountability. I would use again the example of digitalization. You put the government out for people to see, and then every man and woman and even a child is your controller because information is power. And the third area where I see technology being so absolutely critical is to bring solutions to problems that are of the magnitude of climate change. And yes, without technology, we cannot get to sustainability at all. Now, this all being said, of course, there are scary things about technology. The technology can be also a big divider. If we are to not invest in access to the internet in Africa, we will have the better offs in one part of the world and those that are not there in another. And of course, technology can be scary if we don't think of policy aspects in policy terms of having checks and balances of who gains from it and what risk there may be.
And David, I think you're going to close us out. Sadly, we're out of time here. Where are you most optimistic about how technology can really support and help in your really critical work?
Well, Kristalina said it all, so I'll try and be brief. She gave an absolutely brilliant answer. Of course, none of us are excited by technology per se. What we're excited about is what technology can enable human beings to do. And the great battle is to make sure that the enablement is for positive ends, not dark and dangerous ends. And so I agree very much with her warning. I mean, what I think that technology can enable us to do is break down barriers. And the barriers that exist are barriers of poverty, they're barriers of race and religion, they're barriers of geography. And what we try and do in our work is marry global expertise with local knowledge, local expertise. And so to take the malnutrition case that you cite, 80% of the world's malnourished children under the age of 5 get no help at all at the moment. That's significantly because the course of treatment requires 6 or 7 weeks of getting to a health center. And when you stop and think about it, there's no reason to have to get to a health center either for the diagnosis of malnutrition or for the treatment of malnutrition. You can do it in the community. And actually, a mother or father or a carer or a community volunteer can diagnose and treat malnutrition. You don't need to be a doctor or even a nurse to diagnose and treat malnutrition. Now, here's the thing. The technology end of treating malnutrition is actually not the very sexy end of things. It's pretty low tech. I mean, measuring the upper arm circumference of a child doesn't require everyone to have an iPhone to take a picture of the upper arm circumference, and then the algorithm gets fed into a global computer. What you need is actually a little bit of color-coded measuring tape that allows someone who is illiterate or innumerate to recognize that the kid is in danger, and then they need to be able to match that measurement to a dosage of ready-to-use therapeutic food that helps build the child back. Where the technology is enabling is of the staffing, the training, the supplies. And I think, I guess my message would be, or my lesson is, be really clear what the balance between the digital world and the analog world is. Because if you try and solve digital problems with analog means, you'll fail. But if you try and solve analog problems with digital means, you'll also fail. And I think there's enormous productivity gain, human resources gain, security gain, actually, from the appropriate use of technology. But of course, that's going to require some real thinking about the global public good of reaching the whole population, because NGOs aren't funded to pay for these things. It challenges various business models. And so I guess my excitement is that we're living at a time when there are more resources to do more good than at any time in human history. And woe betide us if we fail, because it's inexcusable to have the resources to make a difference and then not to be able to organize yourself to do it.
I will take that as a positive note on which to end. The art of the possible. We do have the resources. We do have a coalition of the willing. We do have an urgency to act. And thank you both, Kristalina and David, for your comments today.
That was Alphabet and Google's CFO, Ruth Porat, in conversation with IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva and David Miliband, CEO of the International Rescue Committee, on Google's Zeitgeist podcast. Look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.